Hello and welcome to the Critical Ecologies podcast, which is a series of interviews with master's or postgraduate level students in the geography department in Maynooth. So these are students who are taking the module in spatial justice. So some of the students are actually drawn from other departments. And in this case today, we have Melanie Johnson, who is from sociology, doing the master's in sociology. So Melanie's done some work, her essay on degrowth, and that's largely what we're going to talk about today, degrowth and spatial justice. So maybe just before we get into that, Melanie, you could say a little bit about yourself and where you came from and how you got interested in the topic.
Yes, hello. So I am from Washington State in America. So that's the little state just below Canada in the top left corner there. And I'm near the Seattle area. I'm not about an hour or so away. So I live on the peninsula. And I got my undergraduate in psychology. And when I graduated back in 2020, I just kind of noticed when I got into the working world, I was doing social work at the time, that myself and my peers who moved back to the Seattle area, we had all this knowledge about structural inequities and just kind of like the state of the world and social justice problems that are like going to become more pressing issues over time. And we really did not know much about what to do about it. We had all the information, but not like a direct course of action per se. So I was doing a lot of work in music at the end of my college career. So I was interviewing musicians and I was studying music business, and that's when the pandemic happened. So there was like this entire cultural reset that was going on. And it was actually like that, this reset, not just like for me, it was mostly in music and like where artists were being taken advantage of and were in the space of limbo and having to start over, that I decided I wanted to take personal action in my life. But I had other people around me at the time who were also involved in that world that were kind of just doing the same things they'd always been doing, contributing to similar like predatory streaming services and like that, because they didn't like know what to do differently. And that's when I kind of started asking like these questions. And that's how degrowth really came along into my attention when I had to write this essay for your class this year, because it takes all this knowledge we have of structural inequities and ecological concerns and stuff I've been focusing on in doing my master's in sociology here. And it kind of provides an ethos for what to actually do with all this information.
Right, and I guess we'll get into that shortly. But you actually open your essay with the concept of extractivism rather than degrowth. And obviously they are linked quite closely, but maybe you could just explain a little bit about that concept and its origins and its significance to some of the things that you were just talking about there.
Yes. So extractivism. It has its roots in Spanish Latin American culture. So it was originally extractivismo, and it started out there because that's primarily like the language spoken in the global south of the Western Hemisphere. And it's where a lot of extractivism occurs. And it's basically where bigger companies, so a lot of money, a lot of resources, usually engendered in the global north, go into countries in the global south that have less political clout, less financial funds to fight back on a legal plane. And also like just with like the state of the world and neoliberalism, there's really not a whole lot to hold a company back from going somewhere else and extracting resources from a place they see fit. And there are places in the global south that don't really have any particular private ownership of certain places, that there are resources that certain people rely on. So people are living off of resources, but they don't necessarily like own them in technical terms. So by and large, the global north is going into countries in the global south and pulling out resources to put into economy that is largely going to stay in the global north. So like reaching down into a bag, pulling it out, and then like distributing among your friends almost. But if you look at, there are maps you can look at of like trade routes from imperialism back when like slavery was still like legal. And those same routes laid out on those maps are what are accurate today. That is still like the circulation and flow of resources that is being enacted in our modern economy. And the only thing that's really different is it's technically not slavery, because the workers that are local and are extracting those resources are being paid, but they are being paid very minimally. I have a number here, and that is on how much wealth gets extracted from the global north to the global south, and it's about 2.2 trillion per year. And since like 1960, that has been about 60 trillion over time. And if you kind of equate that number to match modern currency, that like in total would be almost like $200 trillion. So it is just really taking advantage of more vulnerable populations that are vulnerable really because of historical invasions that were violent in their upheaval of the people living there and in taking possession of land that was traditionally common. So now through this extractivist system, there is just a push for more and more resources over time, because the growth system as it is exponential. There's no like set goal or whatever. It's just intended to keep going from privatizing common land. And yeah, sorry, I feel like I went all over the place with that.
No, that's fine. I think it would make sense to lead to the next question, which you write in your essay. A line that kind of jumped out was that in the birth of capitalism, or maybe at the birth of capitalism, it can be seen that the domination of space is essential to what keeps our extractivist economic structures in hyperdrive. So I wonder if you could just elaborate on that a little bit, because it links obviously to this idea of space and spatial justice. And, you know, what you've just talked about there in terms of the like longer colonial histories and how they continue to manifest in kind of global economic trade and systems is clearly this spatial injustice between global north and global south. But I wonder if you could say a little bit more about this idea of the domination of space. And if you don't want to, that's fine. But I just, I like that sentence. I thought I'd give you a chance to talk more about it.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, no, I'd be happy to. No, it was very interesting to go into this, because when I thought of the origin of capitalism, I thought of the origin of colonialism, just the idea that like, we now have ships and all this technology that allows us to go out and like explore, and the way that we make the funding we need to explore worth it is to bring back wealth. And I thought that was kind of the initiation of the perpetuation of colonialism, extractivism. And I mean, it is similar to what we have going on today in our gridlock of growth, because like in order to do what you feel like you need to do, you do need like a massive amount of funding, and then you need that the profit of your endeavor to be exponentially profitable to make that funding worth it. But when I did look into the origins of capitalism, it was more complicated than that. So what's interesting is like, it kind of takes place post feudalism. Yeah, it was post feudalism. So that was a system of basically like, I don't know, slavery, mass slavery, almost essentially, enforced poverty and the like. But the plague, the Black Death, is what really caused that reset, almost like what I touched on in the beginning with COVID-19. There was just significantly less people after that. And usually wealthy elites are protected in cases of natural disasters and things that really like threaten human life. But I mean, sickness doesn't discriminate. So there was a bit of a weakness on that side as well. So there was just more land and fewer people. And that lined up historically for peasants and people who actually worked on the land to be able to leverage that in their favor. So rebellions just became more effective. People who worked on the land were actually able to be responsible for it. I like hesitate to use terms like take ownership, because there was no process of like, we own this, but it was a sense of responsibility. People lived off it, and it was reciprocity. People were taking care of each other, and they weren't taking more than they needed, and they had more bargaining power, like between them and their suppliers, and things were much more on their terms. This period would be about from the end of the Black Death, so about 1350 to 1500. So it was a bit over a century that there was a relatively healthy system than we've ever seen in history in Europe, of living off the land and living communally. And exploitation was a bit at a minimum, but there was still a ruling class. There was still the church. There was nobles. There was wealthy merchants, all that. So they really didn't like not being able to like stockpile wealth and really like make those profits. So they enacted a system called enclosure, which is where they went into these areas like fields, forests, where people were living and growing food and surviving, and they violently kicked them out. Like tons of people were killed, tons of people like displaced. There was mass homelessness. They raised crops, so they literally like burned resources to make sure people couldn't have access to these places. It was like the invention of privatization, almost, like of common land. I mean, obviously that was still occurring before, but it was like the first like mass enforcement of this system. So taking away the space for people to live and people to grow and have that reciprocity that they were living out, that's what kind of reintroduced capitalism as we experience it today. So people were displaced of land. They didn't have anything. They were just kind of wandering. It was a big time for vagabondage. And that's when people who owned property were able to like bring workers under their wing again and be able to overwork them, overwork the soil, and just kind of create this system of hyperproduction where you can stockpile profits once again. That was just kind of on hold for a while.
Great. Thanks, Melanie. I guess, you know, keeping going with this vein around, I guess, the character of, colonialism, capitalism, and its links to growth and spatial injustice. You talk about the growth imperative of capitalism, and I wonder if you could explain that a little bit. What is the growth imperative? Why is it, you know, such an essential part of a capitalist mode of production? And maybe you could also respond to the idea that, you know, there can be good growth, for example. You know, you hear a lot of talk now about green growth. So, you know, we can grow the economy but reduce emissions. You know, we need growth because we need to, you know, raise the standard of living. We need growth to generate wealth. These are all the kind of common arguments that are made in defense of growth. So maybe you could say, like, talk a bit about the growth imperative of capitalism, A, and then B, maybe respond a little bit to those defenses of growth.
Yes. So it's like I touched on before with like the example of explorers, really. So the way that society is set up and divided into nations, and you're like a person living within a mass body of space that is a country, right? So you're not really living with regard to your community in the way we've structured society. It is, you are a member of a large nation of people. You all speak the same language. You have like a certain economic system among this like vast amount of space that like before cars you probably wouldn't even ever see the whole of, you know, etc. And so when you have people wanting to set out on an endeavor, like you want to go on an exploration mission, you want to develop a medicine, you want to start a business, you know, whatever you want to do, you need to do it on a pretty mass scale. And in order to enact such mass scale movement, you need investment, you need the monetary support to even like get that started. And just like the way economics and business finances are set up in terms of what their initiatives and values are, is that it is based off growth. What they want is to just make profits that pile on top of each other exponentially. So just continual profits with no set goal in mind. So you traditionally, if you require investment in your project, that investor is going to want a return on their investment with interest that compiles year after year. So whether you're a business or you're even like a government agency and you have government funding behind you, you still often need the support of investors, which if you bring the fact of government into it, it unlocks just the Pandora's box of a bunch of like complicated geopolitical issues that I can't necessarily go into because it is a whole other topic essentially. But the way we structure society is it's heavily dependent on mass sums of money, and the source where you get those mass sums of money, investors require exponential growth in order to get a return on their investment. So there is a bit of a gridlock there. Sometimes it's referred to as a debt trap because you have to start your endeavor basically like owing money. So whatever your goals are, making money, making more than you were given in the first place to be able to start what you're trying to do, becomes a very primary goal. Otherwise, like the investment will pull their funding and like the whole thing can fall apart. The term degrowth gets a lot of criticism because it sounds like a negative thing. It's the ungrowth, and growth sounds like very natural, very positive, like growing as a person is what you want to do throughout your adult life, you know? So there are criticisms of that term, but it is intentionally meant to be, it's meant to counterpoint what growth is in terms of finances. And if you look at the example of GDP, gross domestic product of a country, it's just basically a number that measures the financial output within a country over a year. And that wants to go up every year, but all it is financial. So I didn't look up what the GDP was in the United States for COVID, for example, but like, let's just say that went up that year, precarious hypothetical there, but if it did, it wouldn't be taking into account all the deaths that happen, all the people that got sick at work and lost their lives. So you're only measuring an increment of money and not the well-being of those making the money or the structural integrity of the systems that are in place to create that profit. So basically, degrowth wants to cut back on just the arbitrariness of growth. It doesn't necessarily want to stop progress. So there's a reason I use the word hyperdrive in the quote about space being essential in capitalist hyperdrive of profits. And that's because we are sacrificing other facets of health by and large in the global North or the global West. Sometimes it's referred to Western civilization. We're sacrificing multiple other facets of well-being and progress in favor of just financial growth. And that's the well-being of ecology. That's the well-being of people. That's the decrease in biodiversity. That's holding back growth in a lot of other ways, discovery of medicines and ways to thrive. And it's also setting us back financially in many ways because of this incentive for growth, like fossil fuel industries, they just keep growing and expanding their profits as much as they can, but that's growing and expanding the output of fossil fuels as well. So that's obviously having major climate impacts, which are going to be very, very expensive in the long run. But because of this incentive for growth here and now, because financial growth in GDP, it's a very short-term incentive. So we're really also just creating long-term costs chasing this exclusively short-term financial goal. And it's just a very limiting view. So it's almost like degrowth is wanting to pull off of a highway a little bit. Like we're speeding down this highway that has no destination in mind. And maybe if we pulled off the highway and like took it slower, took more turns and like saw more sights, we'd have a better idea of where it is we're going and what we're trying to do.
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. I guess I have a question still about the kind of growth degrowth, which is that you talk a lot about, say, capitalist growth or growth within a capitalist system, which is very much driven by the need to maximize profit and the fact that companies are in competition with one another. And it's all about cutting costs and, expanding your market, say, selling more stuff. But there is an argument which is anti-capitalist, which is still for growth. So the idea of a kind of Green New Deal, which is maybe you wouldn't say was anti-capitalist, but the idea of regulating to some extent the kind of maybe hyperdrive of capitalist accumulation by investing in infrastructures and investing in production, industrial production, which may, it continues to grow things, grows the throughput of materials and the throughputs of energy, but is not for profit. But it's still wedded to certain ideas of, increasing wealth, redistributing that wealth, but ultimately growing that wealth. So I was wondering if you could say something about that, because it's, there are those who are critical of capitalism, if not anti-capitalist, who are still very much pro-growth and anti-degrowth. Mm-hmm. And once you take profit out of the equation, that it's not about maximizing profit, it's about maximizing well-being via certain, models and measures of growth, economic growth. Is that clear?
Like a well-being economy, yeah.
Could be a well-being economy. I'm thinking more about kind of a Green New Deal. I'm thinking more about the idea that like a certain version of the Green New Deal in the US is about absolutely expanding the industrial base and including more people into, I would say, certain kinds of lifestyles, certain kind of modes of consumption, which degrowthers would be critical of, because ultimately they require more resources, more energy. Degrowth, fundamentally, initially is coming from an ecological critique. It's not just a critique of GDP and a question about social justice. It's an ecological critique, degrowth, which is that we have to reduce the amount of resources that are extracted and sort of entered into sort of economic processes. And we need to reduce energy use, not just replace it with wind energy or replace it with solar. So I'm just trying to get you to tease that out a little bit.
Okay, that's very interesting, the notion that it's not for profit, because I mean, what you're saying it ultimately does is it expands and it does propagate like a distribution of wealth. Like, I mean, if you're going to get, again, like the funding to do any of this type of thing at all, like green energy and products and the like, you're going to have investors, you're going to have people putting in money to make this possible and wanting the return on their investment. Like the only way to get an undertaking like that across is mostly through private funding, and most of like government funding does kind of ultimately come from private funding these days. So I don't know if this is something that could necessarily be not for profit in layman's terms. Like I think that the only way to achieve this incentive is going to be like a bit of a profit driven system, just like everything else. So it It still would be counterintuitive to degrowth, I believe. I think when we think of degrowth, one of the reasons that the term is what it is because it is placing priority in more localizing, like more small, scaling back and taking care of things like on a, like a more immediate surrounding scale. So Duthwaite wanted to localize economies more. He doesn't.
You could say a little bit about Richard Duthwaite, because I'd say that he's not, even though he's written about these kinds of, you know, critiques of growth and so on, he's probably not as well recognized as other writers in the field of degrowth. So maybe you could just say something a little bit about him.
Yeah, it's really interesting that he wasn't exactly a propagator of the term degrowth, but he was an avid critic of growth. Like he wanted to really break down the economics of sustainable development. And every time he endeavored to do that, he always talked about localizing economies, and like even having communities have their own system of currency among themselves that worked for them. And I don't think he necessarily found it within the foreseeable future to completely divest from more large scale systems of currency like the euro or the dollar or whatnot, but he did want people to ultimately like scale back and rely on like their more immediate communities more. I mean, he wrote The Growth Illusion, which was a huge critique of the concept of growth in general. And while he wasn't exactly coming around at the end of it going like, this is why we need degrowth, he was pointing out like, this is kind of a system that is ultimately shooting humanity in the foot in terms of like having a future at all. So to circle back to the green energy thing, it's not a horrible goal. It's not a bad idea to want to transition in the way that we grow, because there's like an issue a bit in the United States right now where the left politics really aren't capitalists at all in their ethos. At least that's kind of what it's leaning towards. But if you look at all our politicians who are Democrats on the left, they are still very much capitalists. So there is a bit of a problem there. And as we learned about in our course with the transition to green energy still being heavily relied on extractivist economies, this is going to be almost just like a cleaner form of capitalism, and not in an ethical way. This is going to be like literally like extractivism capitalism with maybe like fewer pollution for the entire globe. So we'll still like raise ecological habits in certain ecological havoc in certain areas while keeping it cleaner elsewhere, which I think is definitely demonstrative of the ethos of extractivism, because extractivism kind of, it's almost like NIMBY behavior, if you will. Like it's the idea of going and taking resources from somewhere where you don't have to feel a lack of those resources, only other people will. So while degrowth Well, degrowth does aim to protect ecology. I think personally, the way I interpreted the ethos of degrowth is they're protecting that ecology in the name of humanity, because we are not separate from ecology. Like the way Western civilization trajectory has been going, we've been trying to like put structures on top of ecology and extract from it to kind of separate ourselves from it more and more. But the idea of degrowth, which is space-oriented, it involves returning to the commons, like the pre-capitalist state where land was just available for people to live and survive from. Like the health of that ecology in that space is what's important. And you can't maintain that health and that reciprocity without availability, which is what degrowth seeks to value. So it seeks to protect ecology in the name of humanity's ability to thrive in a symbiosis with it.
That's No, that's really clear and well said. And I we're running out of time, so I wanted to just return to one point, which is it's not so much that there's a there's not so much there's a contradiction, but there could be a tension, is what I would say, between, on the one hand, some sort of tendencies towards localization, which you already said that Richard Duthwaite, for example, talks a lot about in terms of sort of localizing economies and, you know, I guess bringing production and consumption closer together. But then on the other hand, your understanding of, you know, at least 500 years of, you know, imperialism, colonialism, which has wreaked havoc, particularly on the global south, and that continues to today, you know, not least in terms of climate change, that these places are most vulnerable to climate change, the least infrastructures to deal with it, and so on. So there is a question here between, on the one hand, localizing economies, possibly in wealthier, less vulnerable parts of the world where you can grow food and there's some infrastructure to do stuff and access resources. And then in other parts of the world that have been, you know, ruined, they don't have as much capacity to localize their economies and so on. And they need reparations, effectively. They need, you know, massive transfers of wealth. And they also need to grow their infrastructures because they have been so de-developed over the last 500 years. So I wonder if you could say something about that, whether you think within degrowth itself, is there some kind of, you know, is there a need to sort of think about these different scales together? Otherwise, we can kind of, you know, by localizing, we can lose sight of these much larger global sort of spatial dynamics and inequalities. How do they relate to one another, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, so localization is going to have to be a bit of a grassroots effort, because I don't think you can take these values, like the system of degrowth, to, like, again, our presently capitalist leaders and be like, hey, get on this. You know, it's going to have to be from the ground up. So I would say there's actually efforts in degrowth in, like, mostly, unfortunately, like, more vulnerable efforts parts of the world now, such as India and Ghana right now. And those groups are engaging with their, I believe, already smaller governments to focus on localizing, because that's what works for them in their area. And there might be more vulnerable parts of the world that do require reparations and a little assistance in, if there was a system of extraction that were to, like, be suddenly pulled out, you wouldn't want to, like, leave those people in the dust. But I think degrowth as a system of action would be primarily applied to the source of the problem right now. So if you're living in the global south and you're dealing with the consequences of extractivism and not having enough, you're not contributing to the hyper consumption, the hyper production that is, like, the cause of all that. So degrowth would have to be enacted by people in the global north in more privileged economies to change their values and behavior. So they would have to consume less, to rely on each other more, to try and make it popular to not contribute financially to what you don't believe in. Like I was saying about how you get an education, or in my experience, me and, like, my peers around me got an education and we gained this awareness of all these things that we are a part of, we perpetrate in our society that are harmful to people elsewhere, but we don't know what to do about it. Like, for people like that, degrowth is something to do. It is a system of ethics to try and live by and to strive to rely on each other more and look around at what we have immediately and not fund our money into places that are just going to take those finances and try and pump out resources from places that don't belong to them. I mean, like, maybe they have legal access to them, but they're not from there. They have no right to monopolize a resource that maybe other people depend on. And if I believe that, I don't want to contribute to that. I would rather try and enact a system among me and among the people around me, where we can be independent from that.
I think that's probably a good place to leave it. I know we didn't get through all the questions.
I completely forgot about a time limit. I'm so sorry.
That's fine. That was a great sort of a conversation about degrowth, which I think, you know, there's lots more to say, and I think
there's so much more to say.
Yeah, and lots of people, you know, working on it, and it's good to see it as a concept that has sort of grown an interest and popularity, at least. And it's going to be, important debate and important kind of movement to, I think, contribute to. So thanks for that, Melanie. And I hope, whatever you do after the masters, you continue to build on these ideas and this work. And I look forward to seeing what you do next.
Thank you. Yeah, there's actually tons of great groups in Ireland that are, I don't know if they're like necessarily enacting with the government, but they are doing their best to kind of live this way. There's Anti-Share, The Free House, The Happy Pigs, started by Mark Boyle. I believe that's in Galway. There's Circleway, that's another community out in Galway that does its best to try and like live amongst the land and amongst themselves. And there's Clough Jordan as well. Don't fully remember where that was, but that is also an eco village, and they are more open and have tours for how to live sustainably and enact community values to rely on each other as well. So yeah, there's lots of people out there doing their best in this country in particular. So I think that's really great.
Great. Thanks, Melanie. Best of luck with the rest of your masters and what you do after that.
Yes. Yeah, of course. Thank you.
Great.